This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On this Veterans Day, here's a report from a soldier on the front. My company ran into a truck sitting in the middle of the road we straddled. A running automobile sat stopped in front of it. Several Iraqis were leaning and reaching into the cab, doing something, trying to start it, recovering weapons, booby-trapping it. Belergian had a Bradley shoot warning rounds over the truck. The Iraqis scurried into the running car and sped away. Wanting to take no chances, Belergian chose to destroy it at a distance with a high-explosive tank round. I asked my platoon if anyone had a heat battle carry. Sergeant Miller assented. Belergian had his thinner-skinned Bradleys back off. I told Miller to lock on the truck and for him and his gunner to speak their fire commands over the platoon net. I echoed every command over the company net. Ready, ready, fire, fire, on the way, on the way. I'd expected a more dramatic explosion, as had the watching infantry. A small flash and puff of smoke, the sound of crunching metal and glass, and the truck jerked and rocked back to stillness. Though the account sounds as if it might have arrived today, it's from an earlier Gulf War, February 28, 1991. The man who wrote it, Alex Vernon, is among our guests today as we focus on the experience of war, not just what happens in combat, but how the experience can change people. Later in the program, divisions over the war in Iraq spill over into a debate over a war memorial in Vermont. But first, if you're a veteran, did your chime in uniform change you? How? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin with Vietnam vet Tim O'Brien, one of the best-known contemporary writers on the subject of war. His many books include Going After Cacciato, which won the National Book Award in 1978. The Things They Carried has been turned into a play, which opens today in New York City. And Tim O'Brien joins us from our bureau in New York. Thanks very much for being with us today.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
And congratulations on the play. Good luck with it.
Thanks.
I know the question of how war can change you is difficult to answer. You went to Vietnam as a private, came out as a sergeant, went as a young man, came out as an older man.
That's true. Not just an older man, but a radically changed man. You go to war full of romantic notions about yourself and your country and the world, and you come home a little less romantic, a little less idealistic, and perhaps a bit more cynical.
Lost is a word that comes up sometimes in your books, specifically Mr. Cacciato.
Right.
Lost, is that a word that you would embrace?
Probably the best word to describe my experience in Vietnam. I mean, lost not just geographically. I rarely knew where I was on any given day. But lost, more importantly, in a kind of spiritual or psychological sense. A confusing war, a guerrilla war, no front, no rear, no battle lines, who's the enemy, who's the friend. Kind of lostness that, even to this day, infects my dreams.
To this day?
To this day.
We think of war, and one of the things you're talking about, I guess, is the experience of combat, but obviously you spent a great deal more time out of combat than in it.
In terms of my life, of course, yeah. War happened half a lifetime ago.
Yeah, but
impossible.
Even in Vietnam, I mean, it wasn't all, firefights.
I see. Yeah. No, it wasn't. I mean, there's always, unfortunately, though, the expectation or anticipation. You may be sitting at the top of a high hill, utterly bored, and suddenly your boredom is broken by gunfire, 4 meters away. So there's always that sense in your stomach. It's like acid dripping droplet by droplet, even in the good times. So even though you may not be in combat all the time, of course you're not, there's that ticklish, acidic feeling in your stomach where what happens next?
Your dad fought in World War II. I wondered, did you two ever talk about your experiences before or after you went to Vietnam?
We did talk, but in a kind of general way. My father, like many veterans after war is over, mostly stayed on the light side in his stories, jokes, things that happened aboard his destroyer in the South Pacific. He would talk now and then about, moments of actual combat. But for the most part, like a lot of veterans of Vietnam as well, he stayed largely silent, which partly is what makes Veterans Day an important day. Suddenly that silence is being broken in a kind of national way. We're remembering.
I know you've thought a lot and written a lot about how war changes people in general and yourself in particular. I wonder, thinking back, do you have any idea of how war may have changed your father?
Yeah, I think that he carried with him till he died very recently in the last, 2 months or so. And among the few surviving memories, he was suffering from a kind of senility and perhaps even incipient Alzheimer's, how do you know? But of the few lasting memories, he had forgotten my name, in fact. Those memories were of his time aboard that destroyer, the color of the water along outside Okinawa or Iwo Jima, the names of some of his shipmates. Those things he could remember, so it was clearly a really important part of a man's life who would live to be 90 years old.
Looking back on your memories, is there anything more vivid than those days in Vietnam?
I can't say no to that question. I think probably when I'm the age of my father when he died, 90 years old, whatever I happen to be, the faces of the men in my platoon, the horrid things I witnessed and even did, will be there for me. I hope, you know, that my friends and family are there too, among my last memories. But going to war is a bit like having a disease like cancer or heart disease. You suddenly are face to face with death. It's with you. It's always proximate, right around the corner. And those, because of that, life is heightened in a strange kind of way. The day is brighter and the sun is hotter and the Coca-Cola is colder. You're away, alive in a way that you're not so wholly alive when you're not almost dead.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. If you'd like to join us on this Veterans Day, it's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And we're trying to get through on line three, but we're not having any luck getting through on line three. I'm just looking into the control room. All right, well, we'll go to, well, apparently this is a generic problem. And we're having difficulty with the phone, so we'll work that out. I apologize to the listeners and to Tim O'Brien. Obviously, one of the things that is most peculiar about that experience you were talking about so vividly is that it is utterly different for every individual, even for someone who may be only a couple of feet away from you.
I think that's an important thing to say, Neil, is that there probably were as many wars as there were soldiers. Even if you're side by side during, say, a firefight, if you're looking to the left and your buddy is looking to the right, you're going to see utterly different things, and your memories 10 minutes later will be different. Or if you're a bomber pilot up, you know, at 10,000, 20,000 feet, you're going to see an utterly different war than a man on the ground. So angle of vision, rank, all personal temperament, all these things determine what you're going to witness and what you're going to remember. My company commander, for example, came to visit me years after the war, and although I was literally hooked to him by a cord, I carried his radio, our memories were oftentimes of utterly different things. He would remember this, and I would remember that on any given day. It was astonishing how varied our memories were of a war. And I guess I issue this as a kind of warning for all Americans not to lump all veterans into a single homogeneous category. We're different politically. We come from different ways, you know, walks of life. And our memories of war, our feelings toward war, our attitudes toward war are, you know, oftentimes radically different. We're not just a group of guys all alike and women all alike.
Joining us now, we've finally gotten through the phone problem, proved to be minor, and yes, my fault. But Ronald joins us now on the line from St. Louis. Ronald, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. I was kind of timid in calling in on this since I didn't actually serve in combat, but I joined my unit 2 months after they came back from Vietnam. And through various circumstances, I had qualified for the Green Beret test, washed out, and ended up in a recon unit in the 1st Cavalry Division. And the experiences that these guys had, just in training with these guys, scared the hell out of me. It made me wonder, you know, if I had really gone into combat without somebody to teach me the things that they knew, how long would I last? We set up a training circumstance with defending a machine gun hill. And there was forest on one side and there was grass on the other side. And it was my turn, after we had raided the hill several times unsuccessfully, it was my turn to defend it. And we had about 3 or 4 of these combat vets with us, and some of these other guys were just standing around. I set up my position and all that, and he says, well, I don't think that you have your men placed right. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, you got too many men over here on the side where the trees are. I said, well, that's where they're going to come from. They're going to hide behind the trees. He says, uh-uh, they're not going to come up to the trees. They're going to come up to the grass. And I said, oh, come on, you can see up to the grass. He says, well, we'll see what happens. And by golly, those guys had crawled up to the grass. They were within 60 feet of us when they jumped up and attacked us, and we were just overwhelmed. And it's things like this that I found in my training that really shocked me. Like, most of the things I learned from these vets, if I just kept my mouth shut, it would come out while we were on field training exercises as we're sitting around a campfire or something after the action was over. And they'd start talking about Vietnam, and I'd just listen patiently. And I'd hear all these things, and I heard from one of my buddies that one of the guys in my platoon had been in a helicopter crash in Vietnam. And what had happened was they had like 120 helicopters on their way to an attack, and they went up over this hill at treetop level and had come down the other side and ran into about 4 or 5 Loaches, which are small two-man helicopters. And the first 7 helicopters disintegrated in the air with the Loaches, and he was not strapped in. He was next to the door gunner, and he got thrown out. He was the only one in his helicopter that survived, and he only survived because he landed in some trees. When I mentioned this to him, I said, I heard you were in a helicopter crash. He was so shocked, and he was so hurt, and I could just see like I was the most dirty son of a bitch that had ever lived in the whole face of this earth. And, you know, you just don't talk about these things with these guys, and the reactions that they had were so shocking to me that it just made me, you know, wonder, what would I have been like in Vietnam, you know? So the effect that I saw of these guys, they were perfectly calm in normal duty life. This is after coming back to Texas from Vietnam. But the slightest thing could touch them off, but for the most part, they're very cool. Once we had our barracks shot up by about 2 or 3 bullet rounds from a small caliber pistol, the way that they reacted was so calm, like they knew what was going on, but they were concerned about those of us who were new, who didn't know how to protect ourselves, that we didn't know how to react to flying rounds. And they wanted us to get down on the floor while they were trying to find out what was going on. Mm-hmm. It's just a completely alien type of mentality, not cold-blooded, but just very set in their ways, that they understood the world. They were not arrogant about anything. They were very cool-minded in certain ways.
I just wanted to get a response from Tim O'Brien. I wonder, A, if that sounds familiar, and B, and I'm afraid we only have a few seconds left, how long did it take you to come to terms and begin to write about Vietnam?
Well, I began writing about Vietnam in Vietnam after a day's march while other guys were horsing around. Right before dark, I would sit at my foxhole and scribble down a few things about what had happened that day. In response to what was just said, I can say one thing, which is that it's the things they carried, for example, I try to make a big deal about how young we all were. Guys fighting wars, it's easy to forget this, are 18, 19, 20 years old. I think of them now in my old age as kids. And some of the things that the caller just described, we have to bear in mind that, by and large, the people on the ground are young, and mistakes such as you just described are fairly common.
Yeah. Regrettably, obviously, in war, those mistakes can end up killing people. So
they sure can.
Yeah. Tim O'Brien, again, thanks very much for being with us. By the way, Ronald, thank you very much for the phone call. I think Ronald has hung up, but anyway, we thank him for his phone call. And again, good luck with the play tonight.
Thank you.
That's the things they carried opens tonight in New York. Tim O'Brien joined us from our bureau in New York. More when we come back from a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On this Veterans Day, we're talking with writer Tim O'Brien, a veteran of the Vietnam War, about how war affects the warriors. For those of you who've been in uniform, how did the experience of your time in the military change or shape you? Of course, you're invited to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And curiously, I was talking about mistakes at the end of the last segment. I made one in suggesting that Tim O'Brien was leaving us. Mr. Clever strikes again. Tim O'Brien is with us from our bureau in New York. And I wonder, you were, again, started Vietnam as a private and ended as a sergeant. How does rank affect your experience?
It determines the sorts of things just physically that you'll look at. If you're a private and you're in a firefight, for example, your face will be buried in the ground or you'll be peeking up. Whereas if you're an officer, you've got to be in front and you have to have your eyes wide open. You can't close them as I often did during firefights. You have to be aware tactically of what's going on around you in a different sort of way. So you're processing even a small thing such as a firefight, you're processing it in a completely different way than, say, an enlisted man would be. Another example is officers, by and large, knew where they were geographically and why they were where they were. But if you're just following around, you have no idea of the name of the village, why you're at the village, what you're supposed to accomplish in any grand sense. Hmm. And hence you feel a kind of bewilderment a great deal of the time as a mere enlisted man, not sure even which direction oftentimes you're supposed to go, unless there's an officer right beside you. So, I listening oftentimes to programs on Veterans Day, I often wanted to get this little pitch in by saying, well, boy, there are many kinds of veterans and many experiences, and the word veteran is an umbrella that covers so many different kinds of experience.
Youssef Kobanyaka, does bewilderment sound like a word that you would associate with your experience in Vietnam?
I think so, but also I would like to address the fact that I grew up in Bogalusa, Louisiana, and I think I experience or internalize a symbolic violence even before I got to Vietnam. So violence was there within the context of my psyche. But I also began to measure myself against violence in a different way in Vietnam. I began to critique violence there and not accept the violence that I had been given through images and the context of my own life growing up in the Deep South in the 1950s.
Youssef Kobanyaka started writing as a soldier in Vietnam. He won a Bronze Star for his work as a correspondent and editor of the military newspaper The Southern Cross. After the war, he became an award-winning poet and now teaches humanities and creative writing at Princeton University. He's with us from the studios of WXPN in Philadelphia, and thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You said you were talking about how that experience of violence in the Deep South where you grew up, you took that to Vietnam and began to think of it in a new way. You're also exposed to, and this happens to anybody no matter where they come from, in the military you're exposed to people from a whole new different range of experiences that you've never known before.
Right, definitely. Those individuals who you attempt to defend this... It's situational, I think, because you're there together, and consequently, in the context of the battlefield, you are there to defend each other, you are there to look out for each other, but as soon as that confrontation, or a number of confrontations in the context of the battlefield ends, and there are social experiences, there's that kind of move back from friendship that has been influenced through necessity.
Hmm. How do you think your experience of war changed you?
I think it made me think about violence in a different way. I began to critique violence. I began to back away from violence. I didn't accept the images of violence any longer. And because I grew up watching war movies, movies about cowboys and Indians and what have you, and all of that was in a context, in the context of my psyche. I had internalized that, and I had not critiqued that violence in any way. So the process of critique happened, began to happen in Vietnam. I thought I would write initially essays about my observations, but I ended up writing, of course, poetry, which is really a composite of images that associates me with my experiences in Louisiana as well as in Vietnam. And places began to merge in my psyche.
I wonder if, like Tim O'Brien, you began writing it while you were there.
Yes, I think so, because there's a kind of writing that takes place in the head even before we face the so-called fearful white space of the page.
I think anybody who's written anything remembers the fearful white space of the page,
right,
but
yes.
Certainly less terrifying than many of the other experiences you both
right,
have had.
Yes, for sure.
And Tim O'Brien, did you think when you started writing those notes that you were going to write a book? What did you think you were going to do with it?
I wasn't quite sure what it was. They were little, you know, one-page vignettes about what may have happened that day. I wasn't even sure I was going to survive the war, much less become a writer years later. But I did feel an urgency to put something down on the page. Like Yusuf, a lot of the writing, I think, was happening in my head, though to describe it now would be impossible. Things were forming in my head that if I were to survive the war years later, I would want to put down. Partly for catharsis, but most importantly, I think, to communicate with people back home. Here's what war is. It's not pretty, and it's not glorious, and it's not even necessarily patriotic when you're in it. It's just ugly, and ugly forever.
Let's get a caller on the line. Kenny is with us from Beaufort, South Carolina.
Hello there.
Hi, Kenny.
Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi. I happened to watch... and we were soldiers last night, and I found that to be one of the better Vietnam War movies. And I was a Navy corpsman attached to a Marine unit in the early 90s out of Aviano, Italy, with Operation Deny Flight with Afghanistan on the other side of the Adriatic. And I had I'm from Pennsylvania, and I grew up in a very, very, very nonviolent community and family and a very cooperative family. Nobody really argued. If they did, it was just an argument, and it was over.
I don't mean to correct your geography, Kenny, but the other side of the Adriatic is what used to be Yugoslavia.
No, I meant on the west side of the Adriatic. We flew out of Aviano, Italy.
All the way to Afghanistan. To support what?
Not Afghanistan.
You said Afghanistan. That's what I was wondering about.
I'm so sorry. The early 90s, the war...
In Kosovo.
Thank you. Thank you so much. There was an A word, one of those cities up there.
Albania might have been it, yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you. So my point is that I got to view this from a non-combatant point of view, and I've often wondered from a very large perspective how we, when you think about war and how it shapes the way that countries relate with each other, and how... if we didn't fight wars, how that would have shaped, and how you would think about those items in the middle of battle, and if that entered your head, how you can keep your sanity if you didn't realize if we're supposed to even be killing each other. If you think about the Ten Commandments, mm-hmm. It doesn't say thou shalt not kill, or for whatever reason, it says thou shalt not kill. And to me, that seems like a very non-forward movement to even fight a battle, even though we're human and that's going to happen. It seems like it's going to happen. It's been happening for a long, long time.
Yeah, Joseph Kominyaka, as you went through your experience in Vietnam, and as you pointed out, you came from a background of violence, though, as you began to analyze it in a new way, was it because you were suddenly, it was external in a way, or less internal?
It was more external, but also it was where the internal and the external began to dovetail and connect to each other, and one tries to make some sense out of it. So there's a kind of internal dialogue that's taking place, and I think it has a lot to do with survival. It's the survival of the psyche, that one has an argument with oneself, questioning the institutions that we come out of, the church, for instance, as was mentioned with the caller.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea of questioning the Ten Commandments, especially thou shalt not kill, and one is there to do just that. Matter of fact, one begins to argue with oneself down to the very last grain of sand, and put oneself on trial in a certain strange way. And I think that has a lot to do with the situation of veterans coming back from Vietnam, that argument continued within the context of their psyches, and they tried to cure themselves or at least deal with themselves in certain ways, such as, we can say, alcohol. We can also, we haven't talked about the fact that there were so many veterans from that war, Vietnam War, who committed suicide. How about the homeless who are wandering around, you know, talking to ghosts in their heads as well as in that imagined world that they connect to in a very tangible way? It is not an abstraction for them.
Kenny, did the war affect you? I mean, obviously, you brought up a lot of the things that you were thinking about at the time, but how did it affect you in other ways?
Well, you know, as a younger person before I enlisted, I wasn't very very smart fella, but not very directed, and I had a chance to reflect through my service. I was able to discharge and really focus on my business at hand and family, and just things made a lot more sense. When Tim mentioned that things smell better, a flower looks mm-hmm. brighter, even a person that you wouldn't normally tolerate looks, you analyze that person and figure there's reasons for that, and there's toleration. Your struggles become more of a challenge or a struggle that you'll pass through, or not as large as ones that you had before.
Changes your perspective.
Wouldn't stop you.
Yeah. Kenny, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate
sure.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And Youssef Kumanyaka, we wanted to thank you for your time today.
Thank you much.
Youssef Kumanyaka is an award-winning poet, professor in the Council of the Humanities and Creative Writing at Princeton University, and with us from the studios of WXPN in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We're talking with veterans on Veterans Day. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Still with us is Tim O'Brien, and joining us now is Alex Vernon, a professor of English at Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas, a veteran of the First Gulf War, author of that passage I read earlier in the program, From the Eyes of Orion, Five Tank Lieutenants in the Persian Gulf War, and he joins us now from his office in Conway. Good to speak with you again, Alex.
It's good to talk with you again, Neil.
It's probably unlikely that a person cannot be changed by an experience like war, but is everyone able to admit that, do you think?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think most of my friends whom I've talked to about these issues have acknowledged some kind of change, but I imagine that there are people who don't acknowledge that, and maybe I'm being a bit too stereotypical here, but maybe some career military folk don't allow themselves to question, potentially.
Well, you were potentially career military. You went to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and then went through training up until your period in the Gulf War, where you served not as a lieutenant but as a captain in charge of some lieutenants. You changed your mind.
Yeah, I was a lieutenant in charge of a platoon of tankers in the first Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how seriously I ever considered the military as a career, certainly going through West Point, the idea. I did entertain the idea, but having gone through a war, I decided that was not not for me. Being shot at once was enough, and I didn't have the capacity for it, the affinity for it. I mean, some people thrive in the military and in the war, and I discovered that I was not one of those people.
One of the things I know that you found most disquieting was your responsibility for other lives, at least as you felt it.
Right, and I feel that today, still, actually. I had an argument with my father a couple weeks ago over the current war in Iraq, and I feel that responsibility as a citizen that anything that happens in Iraq today is you know, blood is on my hands. And we had an argument about school children killed by insurgents, and my point was that that's my fault too, and my father disagreed.
Can you hear any report from Fallujah or from wherever in Iraq and not feel it? And I wonder, Tim O'Brien, the same thing. But you first, Alex.
Initially, I couldn't. I mean, the first, as the war started, as the lead up to the war was going on, it was incredibly visceral. This particular war has been going on so long now. I wonder actually if it's now, if it's speaking more to the Vietnam veterans today rather than me, because it now is beginning to resemble that conflict more than it resembled my conflict.
Yeah, a lot longer than the 100-hour war. Tim O'Brien?
Yeah, like Alex, I'm more and more beginning to feel an uncanny similarity with things that had gone on in the Persian Gulf War and also in Vietnam. For example, lights at the ends of tunnels. You know, where is the light at the end of this tunnel? Even presuming a military victory, then what? All the civilian deaths, I'm reminded of a lesson I thought we'd learned in Vietnam, which was that a bullet can not only kill the enemy, but create an enemy. For every dead civilian, there's a mommy and a daddy and an uncle and a neighbor and lots of friends, and they're not happy. And the whole business of occupation, I mean, how do you install a democracy? What does that mean? What about forces of nationalism? These similarities, and I could go on for a long while, are beginning more and more not just to hit me intellectually, but to frighten me a bit.
Alex Vernon, can you stay with us a bit?
For a couple more minutes, sure.
Okay, we're going to have to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be taking more of your calls with Alex Vernon, one of the authors of The Eyes of Orion, Five Tank Lieutenants in the Persian Gulf War, and also with Tim O'Brien, whose The Things They Carried opens tonight in New York City as a dramatic production. Stay with us if you'd like to get in on the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to wrap up our conversation with Tim O'Brien and Alex Vernon on Veterans Day, but a little bit later in the program, we're also going to be taking calls about memorials to the Iraq War, which have caused controversy in at least one town. If there's a controversy or something happening on that where you live, give us a call, 800-989-8255, or email us, totn@npr.org. Anyway, let's get a caller on the line. Tony's with us from Indianapolis.
Hi, Neil. I just want to commend you and your guests for this forum today, because I think it's extremely important. The reason it's important is because I think your guest hits on two valid points, is that war can be viewed from different perspectives, depending on whether or not you're a commanding officer or you're or an enlisted person. And secondly, I think is the romanticism that is associated with war is quite frankly misleading. I think people need to understand that to war, there is a smell, there is a reality, and the reality is death and destruction. I mean, yes, there are times when it's necessary, but I think it has to be thing. But my question to the guests, why isn't more people, I guess from my lay perspective, I'm only assuming here, why aren't more people interested in taking on that the point of view which I think your guest is taking, rather than the more romantic point of view that war is really and truly romantic? That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Tony. And let's get a quick answer from Alex Vernon, who has to leave shortly.
I think it's a great question, and I'm not sure what the answer is. I mean, I think probably, especially given how divided this country is over the war, that there are certainly a lot of people who don't romanticize the war. And even among those who are in support of the current war, probably a lot of them are realists and just sort of think we should be there, not out of romantic notions. But I also think it's problematic because fictional representations of war that we see on the big screen, for example, especially those we see on the big screen, as graphic as they can be, there's some perverse logic that somehow that the graphic violence becomes romanticized. It's, even if Platoon means to be an anti-war movie, there's something about seeing it that for young men especially, that there's something about that that they want to sort of, I don't know if it's a test themselves issue, but there's something romantic about the graphic images, which becomes, in a sense, self-defeating for anti-war movies.
Do you have any difficulty watching movies like that or Private Ryan?
I do. Schindler's List, I watched about 10 minutes of and had to turn it off. Other things, the really bad movie, Pearl Harbor, the Ben Affleck movie,
yeah.
I never saw it, but I saw a preview for it in the theater, and all I saw was a Japanese Zero flying low over a woman hanging her laundry out to dry, and just that preview almost sent me out of the movie theater. So the answer to your question is yes.
Okay, Alex, I know you have to go. We thank you for your time today.
Well, thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Alex Vernon, a professor of English at Hendricks College, a veteran of the First Gulf War, the author of The Eyes of Orion, Five Tank Lieutenants in the Persian Gulf War, and he joined us from his office in Conway, Arkansas. And I wanted to ask you about that, Tim. As somebody who's fiction, and you write a lot, you try to convey the experience. Are there any cinematic experiences that you would consider authentic at all?
No, I think those that are successful, as Alex was saying, the most successful movies, for me at least, are those which are least realistic. I'm thinking of, for example, Apocalypse Now. Although the events depicted in that movie plainly never happened, surfing nuts and so on, nonetheless, the kind of Alice in Wonderland, upside-down moral world of a war was best conveyed for me through a film such as Apocalypse Now that didn't try to hold a mirror up to war in a kind of any graphic way, but instead took a war and turned it into a metaphor. It's a power of art, I think, to go beyond the standard and to go beyond the cliché, everything we've seen before. And that's what art does. That's why I'm still, after all these years, a novelist and a short story writer. Is trying to avoid those standard Veterans Day cliches.
Let's take one last call on this subject. Cliff joins us from Norman, Oklahoma.
Yes.
Hi.
Neil and Tim, appreciate you being available for a discussion. I served in the Marine Corps. I was a Marine Corps combat veteran, a 19-year-old infantryman in the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines, known as the Walking Dead. I was over there in 65 and 66. Early on, we landed as a entire unit, and as a battalion, we made a beach landing in 1965 June, about the middle of June. I had a lot of casualties during my period over there. I was able to survive the whole time. I think we were there about 10 or 11 months, and unlike a 13-month tour that was typical, we had gone through some training in Okinawa first, but we had about 70% casualties, and we were close friends, most of us. A couple of observations. One is that the new guys that came in had a difficult time assimilating into the unit, because by the time they got there, we'd been together a year and a half or so, and it was really difficult for them, not knowing what to do, and at the same time trying to be respected by the rest of us. Another thing that has bothered me from that time is just residual impacts such as anxiety and depression, and a term that's known among veteran circles is hypervigilance, where you're just hypersensitive, I think, to issues. Professionally, I was fairly successful, but these problems have occurred or reoccurred, I guess, throughout my life at different periods. That seems to be when I'm under more stress. The problems become more intense. One of the most troubling things, however, to a number of veterans like myself is the inability to establish close friendships. I'm basically a real friendly, compassionate person, but have virtually no close friends. And I think the reason why is because just reluctant, probably, to have a closeness that I might lose, like I did in Vietnam. I've had a family, been married for over 30 years and two wonderful kids, but in terms of male friends, I just have acquaintances, but nothing emotionally close at all.
Tim O'Brien, I don't think Cliff is alone.
No, I don't think so. I mean, part of what he's saying is that it's so simple to look at the casualties of war in a kind of gross, in terms of wounded and dead, but in fact, casualties of war, it has to do with this ongoing sense of who am I, why did I do what I do? For some of us, a sense of guilt, some a sense of sadness. Wars don't just destroy bodies, they destroy lives. Gold Star mothers and sisters. I recently ran into the son of my platoon leader in Vietnam, whose father committed suicide when the son was 6 months old, has never known his father and never will. And that, I call him a kid, he's 26, 28 years old now, he himself, even though he was 6 months old, is one of those casualties of a war that the repercussions go on and on. Wars don't end when you sign a peace treaty.
Yes, I agree, and I think those are the kinds of impacts that just aren't apparent through statistics at all. And I've been fortunate enough to reunite with some of my friends from the Vietnam period. One of my squad members wrote a book called Redwood Delta, probably 10 or 12 years ago, a little paperback book. And from that, we've found other people, and we've had a couple of reunions around the country. But all of us have similar, I think, negative impacts from that experience. And some of us just were not able to be productive members of society. Some of the people we've tried to find just cannot be found. I don't know. We don't know where they are. They just disappeared.
Yeah. Cliff, I wanted to thank you very much for the phone call.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it. And Tim O'Brien, again, good luck with The Things They Carried, which opens tonight in New York.
Thank you.
Tim O'Brien, writer, joined us from our bureau in New York.